Hey, it's me, your heart. Mind if I pick the next song? Listen, even though we're eating better, people who've had one heart attack are at higher risk of another. But Repatha Evolocumab plus a statin lowers LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, and our heart attack risk. So let's talk to our doctor about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. View the important safety information in our banner. Listen to your heart. Ask your doctor about Repatha.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabay Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabay sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabay is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquids simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Welcome back to Season 17 of Truth and Justice, the podcast where we don't just accept the official narrative, we dig into the evidence, find the mistakes in the narrative that led to the wrong person being convicted, and let the facts lead us to the truth, no matter how messy it gets. If you're joining us for the first time, we're just getting started with our investigation into a 25-year-old case that screams injustice. The conviction of Chris Bynum for 5 murders in Gary, Indiana on February 17th in the year 2000. If you're tuning in for the first time, stop what you're doing, go back and listen to episode 1. This is a serialized, long-form season, and all of the episodes will build on themselves. You'll need episode 1 for context. In last week's episode, I gave you the broad picture of the case. 3 victims, Suzanne Wallace, Angela Wallace, and Anthony Jeffers, were found shot dead in a living room at 4412 East 10th Avenue, while 2 others, Sheila Barty and Liz Ayers, were gunned down at a baseball field across town. The Gary Police Department didn't waste a moment tying the crimes together and pointing the finger at Chris with the help of confessions that later unraveled and a witness who recanted when the pressure was on. But we're not here just to nod along with the prosecution's version of events. On this show, as my longtime listeners know, we question everything. Every statement, every piece of evidence, every assumption. Because the truth deserves more than a rushed verdict. This case is a labyrinth, and we're navigating it one clue at a time, determined to find out what really happened. It's been assumed from the very beginning that these 2 crime scenes were connected. And to be clear, they very well may be. But we are not going to assume that. We're going to do what we always do. Go back to the beginning. Over the next 2 weeks, we're going to take a close look at each of the crime scenes independently. And then we'll determine, based on the evidence, if the 5 murders should be looked at as a single crime, a spree killing, or if they're 2 completely different incidents. Today, we're going to be zeroing in on that first crime scene at 4412 East 10th Avenue. a house that turned from a family home into a slaughterhouse in the dead of the night. We're starting out with Corporal Jeff Trevino, the first officer on the scene, whose testimony from the trial gives us our initial glimpse into the chaos. We'll walk through every detail he provided, scrutinize what he saw, and dig into the troubling gaps that emerged under cross-examination. After that, we're going to explore the crime scene even deeper with the crime scene investigator, Maurizio Bertosi's testimony. And lastly, we're going to piece together a hypothesis about what I think actually happened that night. This won't be our last look at the crime scene. Today, we're looking at it from the perspectives of the initial investigators. In later episodes, we're going to do a frame-by-frame analysis of the scene based on our own interpretation of the evidence in the crime scene photos. This case is going to be a long journey, so grab a seat and a notebook, and let's get started. Let's step back to around 2 a.m. on February 17, 2000, a winter night in Gary, Indiana. Imagine you're Corporal Jeff Trevino, a narcotics officer with the Gary Police Department. You've been out patrolling all day, and you've spent hours patrolling the city, and now it's almost quitting time. As your shift winds down, dispatch delivers a jolt. A juvenile caller, voice trembling, young, laced with panic, reports a possible shooting at 4412 East 10th in the Etna neighborhood. The dispatcher adds a note of caution, quote, "Be cautious, it's a juvenile caller." You're only 4 or 5 blocks away, so you put your foot on the gas, turn on the lights but not the sirens, and you arrive at the scene in under a minute. Trevino testified, "I proceeded right to the location, pulled up in front, it was quiet out front, appeared to be dark in the yard," end quote. The street was empty. There was no cars parked haphazardly, no neighbors peeking out from windows. There was just a stillness that Trevino said had his nerves on edge. The house itself was dark. It looked quiet from the outside, which gave no hint at all about the horror that lied within. When he steps out of his patrol car, Trevino is met by a 12-year-old boy. This is Larry Brooks, the son of Suzanne Wallace, one of the victims. Larry was trembling, and Trevino asked him what's wrong. Larry's reply was direct and to the point, according to Trevino. He said, quote, "They're all shot in the house." Trevino then stepped inside the house. Once inside, he found an absolute nightmare. To his right, 3 bodies lied sprawled across the floor. 2 women and a man, each with what appeared to be gunshot wounds to the head, with blood pooling beneath them. Amongst all the carnage stands an 18-month-old girl, Katrina. Clothes were drenched in blood, and she was screaming. Katrina's presence, as awful as it is to imagine, is a critical element in our process of profiling the offender once we get there. Whoever did this had zero compassion for that child. They spared her life, but didn't appear to have given a second thought at all to murdering her family right in front of her, and then leaving her helpless, alone on the couch when they left. Trevino described a, quote, "strong odor of burnt gunpowder" when he arrived on the scene. It's a pungent smell, which indicates that the shots were fired just minutes ago. That gunpowder smell doesn't stick around long, and he notes that it dissipated quickly. Trevino then grabs his radio and reports with urgency, 3 gunshot victims, 1 possibly still alive. Within minutes, another officer, Corporal Dame, arrives on the scene, followed by paramedics at 2:30 a.m. Now put a pin in Dame for the time being. He's going to end up being an important player in the story. He was the second officer on the scene and was involved in the investigation within those first couple of minutes. But he wasn't called to testify at trial. The jury only got to hear Trevino's perspective. Now back to the scene. Suzanne Wallace was still breathing but wasn't responsive. The medics quickly scooped her up and rushed her to the Methodist Hospital. Angela Wallace and Anthony Jeffers, however, were still, and obviously deceased. Now let's pause here for a second and step into Trevino's shoes. You're the first officer on a triple homicide. 3 bodies sprawled in the living room, a toddler soaked in blood and screaming, a 12-year-old who's just seen his family destroyed before his eyes. The emotional toll had to be immense. That type of burden could crack even the toughest cop. But at trial, Trevino seems very grounded. All of his testimony was anchored by the evidence. At least, almost all of it. He described the scene, quote, "You got a table, a couch, miscellaneous furniture, two female white adult subjects, and the legs of a male subject," end quote. On our website, Exhibit 12 offers a close-up, blood-streaked furniture, and the body's positions. Exhibit 13 pulls back, revealing Anthony Jeffers' full body near the kitchen threshold, his legs splayed, while Suzanne and Angela lie near the couch. The images confirm Trevino's words from trial. A small living room, about 12 by 15 feet, furniture jostled but not overturned, bodies close together, the aftermath of a brutal attack. I will say that one thing I'm a little confused about is Suzanne's presence in the crime scene photos. She's described as being rushed to the hospital because she was still breathing, but her body is still on the scene when the photos were taken. You can see some gauze and other medical supplies in the photos, indicating that the medics had at least started working on her when the photos were taken. And Trevino mentions that in his testimony. He confirms that this means that the photos were taken after the medics began treating her. And Dame's report confirms that the medics transported Suzanne while she was still breathing. But Trevino's testimony notes that it's the crime scene techs that take the photos at the scene. That would be Bertozzi and Arnold. But Bertozzi, the crime scene tech, didn't arrive on the scene until 3:02 a.m., about a half hour after Trevino arrived, and he noted in his testimony that Suzanne had already been removed from the scene when he got there. Now, this is likely a lot to do about nothing, but it's just one of those odd things that I always like to make note of. We don't know who took those photos. They were taken on a Polaroid camera as opposed to the rest of the crime scene photos that are 35mm, the ones that Bertozzi's crew took. And like I said, it probably doesn't mean anything groundbreaking, but I just can't help but get stuck on the strangeness of someone stopping to take crime scene photos while there's a critical patient on the ground that needs treated and transported immediately. Of course, none of the medics testified, so we don't find any answers to this mystery. Here was the big bombshell for the jury in Trevino's testimony. Trevino told the jury that Larry Brooks, that 12-year-old boy standing in the doorway, provided critical information that night that ultimately helped solve the case. He said Larry heard two male voices described as black males engaged in conversation in the living room before the gunfire erupted. According to Trevino, after the shots, Larry peeked from his bedroom and saw the victims collapsed on the floor. And here's the really important part. Trevino says that Larry told him, quote, "Chris did it." No last name, no physical description, no context, just Chris did it. That single vague accusation became the cornerstone of the case against Chris Bynum, the man now serving life in prison for these murders. It's a fragile foundation at best, a word from a traumatized child, yet it propelled the investigation forward with relentless momentum. As I mentioned last week, Chris was arrested within 24 hours of these murders. But under cross-examination, the defense dug a little deeper into this claim and pushed for more details from Trevino. Did Larry offer any specifics about this Chris? Trevino's response seems like a bit of a stumble. He couldn't recall the last name, height, a face, distinguishing mark. Nothing. Just Chris. And the plot thickens with a glaring, inexplicable absence. Trevino's original police report, which should have documented this critical statement from Larry Brooks, is missing from the discovery file. Now, this isn't some minor clerical error. This is the first officer's record of a witness naming a suspect in a triple homicide, a suspect who was later arrested and was being tried for these murders. It's a document that should have been the bedrock of the case, preserved with meticulous care and presented as Exhibit A. Yet, it's nowhere to be found in this massive case file. During cross-examination, Graddick, Chris's lawyer, zeroed in, quote, Did you participate in the development of any report? Trevino's answer was kind of a hesitant dodge. Quote, I don't believe so. But later, he backtracked, offering a vague, quote, I think I wrote that in my report, end quote. So think about that. In a case this grave, where a man's life hangs in the balance, as does justice for five victims and their families, uncertainty about where or if he documented a witness's claim about who committed the murders isn't just sloppy. It's what, well, a term that gets overused, but in this case I think it's accurate, a big red flag. Without that report, I'm unable to verify what Larry truly said to Trevino that night, and that void cast a long, troubling shadow over the entire case against Chris Bynum. I don't know exactly what's going on here, but you all know my process. When I come across a damning statement like this in trial testimony, I always go back to the original source document. I want to know if the story's changed or if it was documented accurately all the way back at the beginning. But in this case, I don't have the source document. All I have is Trevino's word that that's what Larry said. Trevino's role in the investigation concluded as other units, supervisors, detectives, and the crime lab arrived to take over. But his testimony lays the foundation for what we're unraveling here. We see a blood-drenched living room, a child's shaky accusation pointing to, quote, Chris, and a missing report that should hold the key to either confirming or denying if that really happened. Before we rush to judgment, though, we need the forensic perspective to fill in the gaps. And that's where Maurizio Bertozzi comes in. He was the first crime scene tech to arrive on the scene that night. We're going to dig into his testimony right after the break. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Hey, it's me, your heart. Mind if I pick the next song? Listen, even though we're eating better, people who've had one heart attack are at higher risk of another. But Repatha Evolocumab plus a statin lowers LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, and our heart attack risk. So let's talk to our doctor about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. View the important safety information in our banner. Listen to your heart. Ask your doctor about Repatha.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabay. Anabay is the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for early Black Friday savings, up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Now, let's pivot to Maurizio Bertozzi, a crime scene investigator with the Lake County Sheriff's Department. He showed up to investigate this case along with his partner, Detective Robert Arnold, that night. While Corporal Trevino gave us the first-person view of the first arriving officers, Bertozzi breaks down the scene details. He was tasked with processing the scene after the initial chaos had ended. His testimony stretched across 2 days at trial and gives us the most detailed look at what was left behind in that living room. So let's walk through his testimony. Bertozzi took the stand and he laid out his approach to investigating this and any crime scene. He says, quote, "We walked into the home, we met with one of the officers at the scene, he gave us a brief synopsis of what happened, what he knew of at the scene, and then we started processing," end quote. Now, processing a crime scene is a meticulous procedure. There's not supposed to be any touching, no moving anything until every angle is documented. Robert Arnold, the other crime scene tech, sketched the layout, measuring distances and noting positions of all the critical elements, and Bertozzi takes the photos. The photos, labeled State's Exhibits 49 through 66, are what give us a real picture of the scene, and in Bertozzi's testimony, he walked through them one at a time in detail. By the way, all the testimonies that I break down in these episodes are available on our website if you want to read the entire record. And I'll be posting most of the photos that Bertozzi talks about with the victims' bodies redacted out of them. Now, here's how Bertozzi described the layout. The living room was kind of cramped at about 12 by 15 feet. It held a couch pressed against the north wall, a wooden table to its side, and a metal chair tipped slightly with a lamp knocked off kilter behind it. Anthony Jeffers' body was sprawled near the kitchen entrance with his head resting against the bottom of the wall. Angela Wallace was closer to the front door, her body partially on or near the couch, arms limp at her sides. And Suzanne Wallace had also been near the door when she was found, but she had already been transported to the hospital before Bertozzi's arrival. Where her body had been, there were blood-streaked pillows and couch cushions, which Bertozzi indicates was a sign that paramedics had moved her slightly as they were trying to save her before they rushed her off to the hospital. He also notes the proximity of the victims. Jeffers was about 3 or 4 feet from the women, with his body angled towards the kitchen. And then we have the physical evidence. This is a list of the items that Bertozzi and Arnold collected at the scene. There's State's Exhibit 110, which was a copper bullet jacket extracted from under a red blanket that had been draped over part of a scene, possibly disturbed by paramedics or initial responders. And just to clarify, a jacket is the outside of a bullet, not the casing, the part that holds the bullet, but the actual bullet itself. Bullets are made up of soft lead, and in this case, that lead had a thin layer of copper around it. That's the jacket. Generally, when you find a jacket like this, it means the bullet passed through something or someone. The lead broke apart as it passed through its target, and the copper jacket made it out the other side. Continuing on with the list, we have State's Exhibit 111. a lead-like slug, its surface scratched and deformed from impact. Like I just mentioned, this would be the inside of a bullet. That's possible this came from the same round as the jacket or a different round. Oftentimes, even if the lead core doesn't fully break apart, it will still separate from the copper jacket. Next, we have State's Exhibit 112, a lead fragment. It's small, but it's significant, lodged in a crevice in the floorboards. And State's Exhibit 113, a spent bullet, its casing warped and blackened, found near the couch's edge. It sounds like this bullet is fully intact, which means it likely passed through something that was too soft to break it apart, but dense enough to slow the round down enough to drop to the ground after a pass-through, rather than lodging into a wall or something. I wouldn't think this is a bullet that had passed through bone, for example. Then we have State's Exhibit 114, which is another copper jacket. Bertozzi described that each item was handled with gloves and sealed in evidence bags. It was marked by Bertozzi and Arnold and then later resealed by Sergeant Henry Hatch, the firearms examiner, to maintain the chain of custody. We'll get into Hatch's testimony in another episode. The two crime scene techs also documented blood smears on the wall near Jeffers' body, which looked like he fell against the wall after being shot and slid down. Another spent bullet was found near a sock on the floor near Anthony's body. The scene was blood-soaked and at a glance looks like chaos. But when you look closer, you realize that the room was cluttered, yes, but it really doesn't look like there was much of a struggle. No flip tables, no chairs scattered, nothing really broken or out of place other than one chair that was tipped back slightly, which caused a lamp to fall. Bertozzi testified, quote, "It didn't appear to have been a struggle," end quote. He suggested the tipped chair was likely a result of Anthony's body falling against it when he went down. When I first read Bertozzi's testimony that there were no signs of a struggle, I honestly thought he was full of shit. But sure enough, if you really look at the details, he's right. Whoever did this, did it quickly, without much of a fight. Bertozzi and Arnold dusted the living room for prints, sweeping every surface, the couch, the table, the lamps, the walls, for prints that might identify the shooter. One usable print was found on a beer bottle, later identified as one of the victims' Anthony Jeffers' print. No other print stood out, a detail that Bertozzi noted during his testimony with some obvious frustration. There were no prints on the couch where Angela laid, none on the table, none on the lamp that had been knocked over. The absence of any usable prints seems to add credibility to the notion that the offenders came in and out with speed and efficiency. They didn't ransack the house, it doesn't appear that anything was stolen, and as I mentioned, there's no sign of any real struggle. No firearms or weapons were recovered from the area of the victim's clothing. Obviously, they took the gun or guns with them, and .38 caliber pistols are generally revolvers, which means there would be no ejected shell casings left behind. Now, we have a total of 9 gunshot wounds, which exceeds the capacity of a 6-shot revolver, so we can infer that either the killer stopped to reload, which would be an odd thing to do in an attack that happened this fast, or there were 2 guns being used. Or the other possibility is that we're double counting some of the shots, meaning maybe someone raised their arm up in defense and a bullet passed through the arm and into the body. 2 wounds, 1 bullet. We're going to take a quick look at the medical examiner's testimony next to break down these wounds. The autopsy reports from Dr. Young Kim break down the wounds on the victims. Jeffers had 3. A back of the head shot, which was star-shaped. There were powder burns indicating close range and likely contact with the skull, like the barrel of the gun was pressed against it. He had a shot to the left side of his face, with no powder burns, suggesting a few feet away, and another shot to the left forearm, which was possibly defensive. Again, no powder burns indicating he raised his arm. Suzanne had 3 shots. 1 to the right forearm. Again, this looks to be defensive. There's no powder burn, so there was some distance there. Looks like maybe she lifted her arm when she was being shot. She also had a shot to the right side of her forehead. No powder burns here either, which means she was shot from some distance. Now, that could be 10 feet or it could be 3 feet. She also had a shot to the right side of her face. This one had contact with a muzzle. There were muzzle marks and powder burns, like the barrel was pressed against her skin. Angela also had 3 shots. a shot to the right side of her face, which had minimal powder burns, so it was at close range, but the barrel wasn't touching her. Shot to the right side of her head, no powder burns at all, and a shot to her right occipital part of her head, where there were powder burns, shot at very close range. All shots were .38 caliber. So all three victims were shot both at a minor distance at least, and they were all finished off with a very close range shot to the head, with at least two of them having the barrel pressed against their head. Now, I'm going to do an entire episode on the autopsies later because based on Dr. Kim's trial testimony, we really can't make any determination on the number of shots fired. His analysis was about the wounds, and he doesn't offer any kind of hypothesis on bullet trajectory while he's on the stand. So we're going to work on that part later. Things get a little confusing during Bertozzi's cross-examination regarding the timing of who arrived when and what might have been moved on the scene or by whom. I pointed this out earlier that we have photos of the crime scene from before Suzanne was transported, but we don't know who took them. I was going through the crime scene photos with someone from Chris's legal team yesterday, and we were noticing all sorts of discrepancies in the photos. A sock in a different position from one photo to the next. A drawer partially pulled out in one, but not the other. A red blanket with the bullet on it or under it. It's not clear if you compare the photos to the testimony. The blinds closed in one picture and open in the next. And none of this points to anything obviously nefarious. We're not talking about a making a murderer type situation where the crime scene photo shows an empty shelf and later one shows some piece of incriminating evidence like the victim's car keys on the shelf. There were no forensics whatsoever found at this crime scene that connected to Chris Bynum. And that being said, the crime scene investigation definitely does leave me with some questions. Bertozzi's work and the autopsies weave a pretty chilling narrative. 9 shots, 3 victims, most of the shots to the head, many at point-blank range in a confined space with no signs of a prolonged struggle. The tip chair and a lamp hint at a minor disturbance, but more than likely they were the result of Anthony Jeffers scrambling to get out of the chair after the first shot. But the scene definitely lacks the disorder of an actual fight or struggle. The blood, bullets, and bodies clustered near the couch in the kitchen suggest a rapid, targeted assault executed with absolute intentionality. And all of this raises questions about intent, planning, and the shooter's familiarity with the victims. After this short break, I'll break down my initial hypothesis about what exactly happened here.
Hey, it's me, your heart. Mind if I pick the next song? Listen, even though we're eating better, people who've had one heart attack are at higher risk of another. But Repatha Evolocumab plus a statin lowers LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, and our heart attack risk. So let's talk to our doctor about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. View the important safety information in our banner. Listen to your heart. Ask your doctor about Repatha.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabe Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off. Plus, free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
All right, it's time to put all this together and try to reconstruct the events that unfolded on 10th Avenue that night. Now, we're not here to jump to any conclusions. We're not assuming that the Ballfield murders are tied to this one. We're just going to let the evidence from Trevino's testimony, Bertozzi's forensic breakdown, Dr. Kim's autopsy reports and testimony helped to frame an initial theory. The living room of the house is a tight squeeze. Couch against the north wall, table to its side, chair and lamp, with the kitchen just beyond and Larry Brooks' bedroom nearby. The victims were packed close. Angela and Suzanne near the couch by the front door, Jeffers a few feet towards the kitchen. A maximum of 9.38 caliber shots rang out that night, most striking the head and several at close range. There were no signs of a prolonged struggle, no weapons left behind, just a tipped chair and a lamp suggesting a slight disruption. Larry says he heard two male voices before the shots, which points to at least two offenders in the room. And while his stories do vary over time, he did say there were two voices that very night to Officer Dame, at least according to his report. Now, a key detail, as I mentioned before, that we can't ignore is that .38 caliber firearms are almost always revolvers, which hold five or six rounds and don't eject casings automatically like semi-automatics do. Bertozzi found no empty casings at the scene, just the bullets themselves. So with nine shots fired, that means either two revolvers were in play, each discharging three, four, five rounds, or just one revolver, which would require a reload mid-attack. So let's paint the picture. It's between 2:05 and 2:25 a.m. Suzanne, Angela, and Anthony are in the living room, and it appears they were just hanging out. Two men, the shooters, enter through the front door, just steps from the couch. Angela and Suzanne are closest to the front door. Angela takes three shots, one to the right side of her face with minimal powder burns. It was close range. The barrel was close but not touching her. She took another to the right side of her head with no powder burns, so a few feet away at least, and one to the right back of the head with powder burns indicating contact or near contact with the barrel. Suzanne's right next to her, and she also took three shots. One to the right forearm with no powder burns, it's likely a defensive wound as she raised her arm. One to the right side of her forehead, with no powder burns again it would be shot from some distance, and one to the right side of her face, with muzzle marks and powder burns, which means the barrel was pressed against her skin. Shots are rapid, deliberate, execution style with the shooter standing over them. If it's a revolver, that's six rounds spent, so a reload would be needed for the next three if all six of those wounds were the result of individual shots. Now, we don't know the order of who was killed first, but this same line of thinking applies regardless. Reloading a revolver isn't a quick process. It takes time, and since no casings were left behind, that means it would be especially slow. The killer didn't just open the wheel and dump out the rounds. They would have had to have been ejected into their hand and then put into a pocket or something, unless they picked them up afterwards, but that seems unlikely due to the mess in the room. Either way, think about what the third victim would be doing while they watched the killer remove all six bullets and reload at least three more. Sit and wait quietly? I don't think so. Once the shooting started, Larry doesn't report any screaming or arguing from the victims. And that's important. I told you last week that in Larry's trial testimony, he says that in the middle of the shooting, he heard the two offenders talking about reloading, but nothing from the victims. As I've mentioned, Larry's trial testimony is not reliable for reasons that will become evident later. And this is a point where I don't think we're getting an accurate version of events. It's also not what he told to Officer Dame that night. He said he heard voices before the shooting. I think that 12-year-old Larry was likely coerced into telling this version because it supported the state's narrative to convict Chris. Let's think about a possible sequence of events here and why Larry would have heard two people talking about needing to reload. First of all, why would they need to reload? Ask that question. It would only be if the victims were still alive, right? If that were the case, you would hear screaming, crying, pleading for their lives. But Larry heard none of that. Now let's say all six of the first shots were shot into the first two victims. That leaves them deceased or close to it, but the third victim is still unharmed. That person wouldn't just be sitting around waiting to be killed next. Or let's say there were a series of shots in all three victims, like two in each. Maybe one is killed and the other two took non-lethal shots the first round. Now you have one or two badly injured victims waiting on the killer to reload. There's just no way they sit silently during that time. Let's also not forget that there were no signs of a fight or struggle or anyone trying to flee out a back door for that matter. Any way you shake it, I cannot come up with a single plausible scenario here that involves one shooter with one gun in a mid-attack reload. I feel like I can say with a pretty high level of confidence that this crime was committed by two shooters with two guns. With that information in mind, this is my basic hypothesis about what happened. Two men came into the house with one thing in mind: to kill all three adults. Period. No robbery, no arguing, no trying to convince them to do something. Most likely the door was unlocked. While it is possible that one of the ladies opened the door for the killer and then fell back onto the mattress on the floor out of fear a few seconds later, I think more likely they were all just laying around when the offenders barged into the house. And the attack was shockingly coordinated. One shooter went straight to the women on the floor and began shooting them while the other went straight for Anthony. I think Anthony took the shot to the forearm first. I think he was sitting in the chair at the time. There's a large pool of bright red arterial blood on the floor just to the left of the chair, right where blood would have been draining out of the hole in his left forearm if he was sitting on the chair. That shot had no powder burns and neither did the shot in his face. I think he was shot in the arm, then in the face. And as the offender moved towards him, dazed, Anthony tried to get up and run. He made it about one step before the killer pressed the muzzle of the gun against the back of his head and pulled the trigger. And Anthony fell face first against the wall and slid to the floor. And I think all of this, the murder of all three of them, happened in a matter of seconds. No conversation mid-attack between the two men, no reloading. It was a blitz attack. Two men and two guns. Then they flipped off the lights and walked right out the front door, in and out, probably under a minute. Before I bring this episode to a conclusion, I want to circle back to Larry Brooks and that missing report that's been gnawing at me. Trevino swore under oath that Larry said, quote, "Chris did it," on that very night at the crime scene. But he offered no details and he faltered under cross-examination, unable to recall more. Remember, he claimed, quote, "I think I wrote that in my report." Yet the report is absent from the discovery file, a gaping hole in a triple homicide case. As I said before, you'd expect it to be the foundation of the file, but it's just not there. And during cross, his uncertainty, quote, "I don't believe so," about writing a report at all, raises alarms when compared to his other statement, "I think I wrote that in my report." There was enough ambiguity here to send me looking for any source document that could confirm Trevino's testimony that Larry told him with certainty that Chris did it on the night of the murders. The source document I was looking for does in fact exist in the case file, but it most certainly does not confirm Trevino's version of events. Quite the opposite, actually. Officer Dame, who arrived on the scene a minute or two after Trevino, did file a report detailing his conversation with Larry that night. Dame noted, like Trevino, that Larry said that he heard two black males and gunshots. But the critical twist here is that Larry told Dame he, quote, did not see the subjects responsible and did not recognize the voices, end quote. No Chris mentioned, no suspect named, just a 12-year-old boy who was clueless as to who had just destroyed his life. Two officers, same witness, opposite stories within minutes of each other. Trevino's missing report props up the case against Chris, but Dame's existing report tears it down with a single sentence. Quote, Larry Brooks claims he did not see the subjects responsible and did not recognize the voices. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
CODA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right Rug.